Stephen Godfrey, welcome back to Phantom Island, presented by Homefield. How are you feeling today?
Pretty good.
Okay.
Is that a loaded question?
No. I just like to check on you.
I'm all right.
Not all questions about... Okay. We'll put
you know
that
what?
To the
That's
side.
Fine. That's yeah. fine. No. I'm just naturally suspicious.
That's what makes you a strong journalist.
Mm. What's going on? What do you want to ask me?
I've been thinking a lot about refs lately.
Okay.
So this is an episode about specifically officiating in the WNBA and to some extent in women's college basketball as well. But I don't know if it's a hot take, but I have a perspective, let's say, about officials in the year 2025.
Okay.
I think everything about how sports have evolved technologically has mostly made it harder to be an official.
Harder.
Yeah.
Is that because of I'm thinking about like Major League Baseball, the sort of Luddite resistance to the technology that would determine balls and strikes, and you want a human being back there, and the umpires union fighting that. Is this what we're talking about?
No, not specifically that. Although that's an interesting case of like, I mean, maybe it is making the job of umps harder in the sense that they might not be doing that specific job anymore.
Okay.
I guess what I mean is that technology, advancements in sports broadly have done two things, I'm going to argue here. Number one, they have made sports and the athletes who participate at them better and faster and stronger and like just more everything than ever before. So that's thing one.
So it's just a better, stronger, faster thing happening that
yes.
your subjective human eye has to interpret rules.
100%, yes.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Stand on the sideline of any high-level college football or NFL game.
Yes.
And you are watching a car crash every 4 seconds.
Right.
And it's so hard to find if a guy was holding. I'm always amazed at that.
Baseball is the same way, where it's just like, oh, cool, everyone throws 105
right
now. And they throw it almost all game long.
Yeah.
And that has to be harder than being an ump in the days where it was like, whoa, 92, you got a real arm on, you know?
Right.
Like just what you have to do is harder.
Yeah, to determine like the outside corner.
Yes.
Okay.
And more importantly, everything you do is subject to heightened scrutiny thanks to technology. We can see so many parts of what happened after the fact and judge all of them, even though in most cases, there is nothing to be done about like, well, you didn't have that angle, or in real time, this was bang, bang, and it was hard to, it was impossible to tell.
In 2006, I got my first high definition television.
Yeah.
And I think we all joined what was then called microblogging, but now we call it social media around, everyone was probably in by 2009.
Yeah.
And it's funny that those things are so close to each other because we suddenly had we had a crystal clear, Ryan, look. We really did. I mean, to jump from SD to HD, baseball, out of bounds in football, and then we could complain about it in real time. So yes, I guess you are painting a picture here of an ump's life being worse for wear.
Yeah. And I want to set all that up to establish that I don't think, and that doesn't even get into like how people act now and gambling. You know, there's a million other things that make it difficult to be an official. And I understand why this is a field that people might be hesitant to get into. And that said,
And you're not even talking about youth sports.
Oh, no. That's all we could do.
That is not
several episodes about
that
the experience of officiating youth sports.
I've lived that as a parent, and those people, my gosh, just shit upon.
The most violence I've ever had threatened upon my person was refereeing flag football at UF. So
you decided to be a referee?
At the UF Intramural League.
Let me tell you how not surprised I am. That you decided to referee a game of intramural.
It was a pretty fun job. The time when these guys said they were going to go to their car and get a tire iron to beat my ass was not fun.
Very Florida.
But you know what?
Very
that's
Florida.
When you say that to me, that's a flag.
Very Florida. Also, let me tell you how not surprised I am that you described that job as fun.
Yeah, that's fair. The officiating issue that we're going to talk about today, though, I think is something of an exception to the rule. I want to be clear. I'm not dragging this out to be like refs suck and everything they do is bad. But women's basketball in particular is dealing with a troublesome time. And it's not just the last year or two. Our guest, Emma Bacchellari, gets into how it's really stretching much farther back than that. Basketball referees have, I think, an unusual job. And there may be some similarities in hockey and football and maybe soccer, but I think soccer is even stretching it, where they have to find this other invisible balancing line. And that is, how physical should this game be?
Oh.
What should be, how we don't want the thing where we're calling everything, every little bump, every little hand check. We're not trying to go that far. At the same time, if we let it go too far, there will be fights.
Without spoiling where the show's going to go, yeah. Is the WNBA too far in one direction right now? Like, are they in their jacked up era like the NFL was?
Yes. I feel fine saying, for people who are coming to this who, with no context, that's where things stand right now. But they are too far and away. Like, to use that example, when the NFL was in the, you know, bone crunching hits and, you know, all of that, I don't think the players themselves were particularly mad about it. I think, like, the players were like, this, to some extent, this is what they wanted football to be. Yeah. If you were a quarterback who was getting bent in half,
traumatic brain injury also alters one's perception.
100%. 100%. But I think what's different here is that the participants are really pissed. Basketball players of all sorts, veterans, relative newcomers, stars, you know, like rotation players, whatever, are all like, the what's going on in the WNBA with regards to how physical play is and isn't policed is not working for anybody.
It sounds like, and maybe we're going to find out in this episode, that it's not there's not a consensus, that some people want it to be more lenient in the interpretation of physical play and some people want more policing.
I think that's part of it. And I think more than anything, what people are looking for, and Emma gets into this as well, is consistency, is sort of the sense of, we know where, whether it's tightly called, loosely called, there is some sense of game to game within a game. We know like where generally we're going to go. We know what the bounds of the sandbox are. And that's lacking right now. I bring this up because I think this is the other this is another part of refereeing that is hard, but it's not necessarily hard in relation to technology and scrutiny and all that. A lot of what officiating is about, I'll relate it to being a parent. You have to sort of say, like, how much rope am I giving these people that I am in charge of? Like, I can't be there all. I don't want to be in all the time. Mm-hmm. There is some sense of, like, some conflict is healthy and some conflict needs to be, like, resolved by the participants.
It's a street policing.
Yeah.
So I was raised by a bunch of cops, and it's like, it's if you ever watch The Wire, the whole put it in the bag concept that gives birth to Hamsterdam is a real basis in police philosophy of, you have to reserve your enforcement of the law or your scrutiny of the individual, because if you're in constant application of it on a micro level, you'll never solve a macro problem.
Sure.
It actually hurts the population.
Yes. That's
which, as parents, we also know that, like, and then I don't know if this works for beat cops, maybe necessarily in West Baltimore, but sometimes the beat cop just needs to go in the other room, shut the door, and lay down for a little while.
That said, when our children get too physical with one another, they don't hold a press conference and say, hey, Mom and Dad need to fucking fix this. Like, they don't go out and sort of tell the world. Because that's the other thing that we get into in this episode. It really stands out how publicly this is all boiled over for the WNBA in ways that haven't been true of other sports.
It seems like it's defining the style, the product, the entertainment product right
it's,
now.
It's certainly impacting.
It's threatening to define it.
Yes, and I think that is probably, if there is a common concern between the league, management, owners, players, coaches, it is that, I think. Okay. That as this league is becoming more visible and popular, we are running into a place where, like, a coach got suspended and fined in the middle of the WNBA finals this year.
Yeah.
Minnesota's coach, because of...
I saw that happen.
Yeah, and, like, that's the kind of thing where that feels like a very clear red flashing light of, okay, we have a problem here. And reasonable minds might disagree about what the solution to the problem is, but if it continues in this way, it will be bad for the sport and its participants, and probably for the officials, quite frankly.
All right, Ryan Naney, what question are we asking today?
Well, we're going to talk to Emma to drill down on what exactly is the problem with WNBA officiating. But before we do that, we're going to hear about our sponsor, Homefield. On its face, Homefield is a collegiate apparel company. They sell you shirts and hoodies and crew necks and joggers and hats, and you can put those items on your body and not be arrested for public indecency. It's a real win-win situation, no? But you should know that Homefield is also, whether they wanted to be or not, something of an art and anthropology archive. Here's what you do. You go to homefieldapparel.com, you click on the featured drop-down menu, and you pick mascots under the fan favorites section. You will then be treated to a fascinating gallery of what real humans thought various animals have looked like over the decades. Now, you've probably heard me talk about the various incarnations of the Yukon Husky, and I own many interesting interpretations on the American alligator and its head. But we've also had some real disagreements, it seems, over what, for instance, a golden gopher looks like. We can't really decide if bulldogs from various schools should be totally jacked or have zero muscle definition. And you know how people want to argue about the bird mascots with teeth? Consider how many versions of these birds have hands with fingers and an opposable thumb. Anyways, it's a delightful way to ponder the subjectivity of the human experience because at some point, one person, and probably multiple, thought, yes, this is a good and pleasant reflection of the animal in question. And you can buy any of those reflections from Homefield and bring them out to the world to share that same ponderousness. Okay, back to the show.
Every rustle in the trees, a potential snare. Close my eyes and block my ears. Cut the cord.
Welcome to Phantom Island. Emma Bachelary, staff writer for Sports Illustrated and co-author of Court Queens, Celebrate the Players, Teams, and History of Women's Basketball, a book coming out in March 2026. Very excited to check that out when it hits bookstores. Emma, we are here to talk about maybe not so much a celebrated topic of women's basketball right now, but I wanted to bring you on to talk about officiating in the WNBA. To set the table for listeners who maybe only have this much context coming in, what sort of, why do you think, like, the topic of the officiating is not working blew up so much in the public eye this season and this postseason in the WNBA specifically?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there are a couple of factors at play here. One is, I think, the fact that this has just been building and building and building for so long. Like, this very much is not a new issue. There have been really deep-seated, long-standing complaints and frustrations about the officiating here from coaches, players, execs for a long time. And I think part of it was just partially that accumulating and hitting a breaking point, and the fact that there are more eyes on the league than ever now, the fact that you have more fans seeing this, you have more conversation about this in, you know, mainstream sports media in a way that just wasn't the case, for instance, in 2016, when they had to issue statements about how officiating screwed up both in game four and game five of the finals. It's just a different stage now. It's under a different microscope that kind of adds more fuel and lets it blow up more. And then I think the other things you have around it are, I think there's a, like, on top of that accumulating factor, you had Nafisa Collier's comments at her exit interview, which really kind of blew up in a way that we haven't seen any exit interview in anything, I'm going to say,
right,
blow up, which were very pointed about officiating, the quality of officiating, and I think also about the way that the league and the way that Commissioner Kathy Engelbert talk about officiating. Just very pointed in a way that we hadn't really seen. The fact that that came on the heels of Cheryl Reeve, her coach, blowing up in a press conference with some very specific officiating complaints, some very heated F-bombs in a way that we don't usually see. And the fact that it then just kept coming, that you had other coaches continuing to criticize officiating through the playoffs that you had. Obviously, this is coming a year after we had some very heated, sometimes used in bad faith, public conversations about officiating because of the way that people were seeing calls made or not made on Caitlin Clark, which, you know, I think blew up into its own kind of problem. And I think all of just that just added up. And you do have some serious structural problems here beyond just bad calls are being made or calls are not being made. But I think all of that kind of combined and exploded.
Is there a consistent thread to what the officiating problem actually is? Because I think, like, you can see headlines where people are unhappy with the officiating, or you can see player comments that maybe are not hyper-specific about what their complaints are. Sometimes they are, but, like, I want to sort of drill down and figure out what is it that WNBA officials are doing or failing to do in the minds of the players and coaches specifically?
One is just consistency, I think, which is not just consistency from one referee to another. I think, you know, you're going to see across sports, there are referees, umpires who will call a game a little differently than someone else. That's can be frustrating, but that's normal. That's expected. But I do think you have a bigger range in the W that can be frustrating. But then there's also an issue of consistency within a game, within a refereeing crew, where things will be allowed to get kind of out of hand through the first half or the first three quarters, and then they'll kind of seemingly realize that they've been letting the players get away with too much physicality, they're not calling this closely enough at all, and suddenly tighten it up in a way that's frustrating when you've adjusted to the flow of the game, you think you know what you're doing, and that obviously reasonably is frustrating. So there's that, and I think when you're talking about the specificity of these complaints, it usually is that the game is allowed to be too physical, that they're letting players get away with too much. And, you know, it makes sense. You have high level competitors here. They're going to do as much as you are allowed to do. And if the refs aren't calling anything, that's how the game is going to be played. You know, I think that just makes sense. So there's that. And then I think there is a larger thing with the idea of, are these the best referees possible? Are they given the materials to do their job in the best way possible? So a huge one that you hear from players and coaches is like the lack of transparency on calls, you know, lack of explanations of coaches feeling like they're not being heard, they're not finding out why something was called or not called. Like a big way to fix that in when it comes to crunch time of game is something like a last 2-minute report, which doesn't exist here. So you have the issue of on-court communication, are the refs talking to you, but then also just like there's no kind of larger mechanism for explaining this at large. And that too is frustrating, I think.
So, you know, as you sort of alluded to, we complain about refs in every sport that has them. Like there's always something to sort of point to and say, the stripes suck. They can't do this job very well. Like you've covered a ton of baseball. You know, like what this looks like. What do you think is different either in substance or tenor about that discussion when it comes to women's basketball that is not the same as, oh, we're unhappy because there's too much roughing the passer being called in the NFL or something like that?
Yeah, totally. I think the difference here is that there is a legitimate structural complaint. Not that there aren't structural complaints around refereeing in other sports. I mean, the whole conversation around VAR and robo-umps. Like, there are lots of different structural things here, but there is something that's big here, which comes to how referees are recruited and retained and what they're given to do their jobs. And I think, you know, the WNBA shouldn't use the NBA as a model for everything. There are lots of areas the W can and should be really different from the NBA, but that is the most logical point of comparison here. And when you look at how an NBA ref can do his job versus how a WNBA ref can do his job, it's different. There is no last 2-minute report. There is a mechanism for replay review, but when you're replaying a call in the WNBA, the same ref who just made the call is reviewing it physically in the arena on the sidelines, crowding around a monitor themselves, versus in the WNBA, in the NBA, that is going to an offsite replay review. That's a huge difference. And then just the structure of how they do their jobs. NBA referees are salaried employees who have a year-round job, who are not allowed to referee at other levels or leagues of the game. WNBA referees are contracted employees who get paid by the game, who have to referee in other leagues in the winter to make money, which makes sense given the schedule of the WNBA and the operating budget of the WNBA, but that creates just a very different system. If you are a salaried employee and this is your only job versus if you are paid by the day and refereeing college or overseas in the winter, it's just different.
And there's also a, I think you've reported on this, and I think maybe the respective leagues have tried to, I don't know, change the language around it, but the NBA will pluck referees from, will pluck officials from the WNBA, and when they do, whether they mean for it to do or not, it always kind of feels like a promotion or a, like, you've put in your time at this lesser sport from our perspective as the NBA, and now you get to have the quote-unquote real job. Like, that feels like that's part of the environment that's being created right now between these two leagues that are in some ways separate and in many ways very much not.
Yeah, 100%. So WNBA, NBA, and G League referees are all in the same pool. They're all represented by the same referees union. And yes, when someone moves from the W or from the G League to the NBA, they say it's not a promotion, but you're moving from someone who's being paid a day rate to someone who is a salaried full-time employee. It is a promotion. And even though they used to explicitly use the language, they have been promoted. They've mm-hmm. stopped doing that, I think, because they recognize it doesn't look very good. But it's still, the press releases read just like a promotion because it is a promotion in terms of how these jobs are treated. It just kind of makes sense. So yes, it's a huge problem that if you are a great referee in the WNBA, you will probably be moved up to the NBA and have that be treated as moving up. And that question of who is left, are they the best people available, kind of answers itself.
Kathy Engelbert, sort of in response to Nafisa Collier's exit interview press conference, has framed the bumpiness with officiating as the norm, as like a normal thing that happens with a growing, relatively new league, has sort of put this in a broader historical context and said, look, you know, this is what happens to every sport. As someone who has been working on a book about the history of women's basketball, do you think that is a fair characterization? Like, this is something that what the WNBA is experiencing is not necessarily unique and is just a product of a timeline? Or do you think that is in some ways an excuse that doesn't really hold up under further scrutiny?
I think it does make sense that this is something that is going to feel like a growing pain that the league has to adjust as it grows, as there are more eyes on it. Yes, completely. But I think what I would counter Engelbert's comments with is that, like, it has gotten to the point where those eyes are there. People are calling for change. I think you have frustration in a way that I think you can fairly say threatens the product just from a business standpoint of the way that players are talking about how games are called, the way that players are perceiving injuries as coming from games being, you know, not called tightly enough, the way that fans are reacting to what they're seeing, potential fans are reacting to what they're hearing about the league when the biggest storylines you hear are refs suck, refs suck, refs suck, this isn't fair. Like, that is not good for the league. And so I think, like, yes, it would cost money, it would require investment to make some changes here. And I think there are fair conversations about which changes make sense to prioritize the most. But I think it's at this point probably, like, you are investing in infrastructure and, you know, the staffing around the league in different ways. This is an investment you should make too, basically.
The other thing that feels maybe distinct about this issue in the WNBA as opposed to other sports is I feel like part of the story this season was the endless parade of this player's getting fined, this coach is getting fined, like really peaking with, you know, Nafisa Collier having to miss the last game of the finals with injury, Cheryl Reeve getting fined $15,000 and getting suspended. Like, I feel like it really stands out. Because we're also talking about, like, Kelsey Plum has talked about this publicly. Natasha Cloud has talked about this. Caitlin Clark is one of the people who's been fined. Becky Hammon, Stephanie. Like, it's not just, oh, people are saying something about this. It's that they're being extremely direct and in some cases, like, extremely confrontational both during the game and after the game. And the WNBA is doing what, using their mechanisms to sort of like shut down that criticism, but it seems to be having no effect. Like, this is all a very long way of saying, like, do you think the WNBA as an organization has a full appreciation of how much frustration there is with the status quo, even if they disagree with it? Or is it more like, hey, we need to tamp this, like, yeah, maybe we need to do something, but our bigger problem is we can't have these press conferences where the refs are getting ripped to shreds anymore. Like, that's the thing they actually want to solve.
I think this year was where you saw the change. I think maybe a year ago, which there were also, I think it kind of has gotten overshadowed at this point, but in the finals last year between the Liberty and the Lynx, there were also some huge controversies around officiating, and that also kind of dominated the headlines of the day. After a really great final series, a lot of talk was about the referees. I think at that point still, there maybe was a perception of, like, this is frustrating, but this can be addressed quietly, and, like, this is a matter of tamping it down, like you said. I think now it has probably gotten to a point where the league recognizes it is so much bigger than that, that you can't kind of play whack-a-mole with these individual fines. Like, players have clearly decided, many players, as you said, it's worth saying what I want to say, or a version of what I want to say, and I'll pay the fine. Like, you can't just get this to disappear. And so I think, you know, when Kathy Engelbert spoke to the media at the end of the season, she did say, like, there's not very much actionable in this, but she had said they do have a competition committee, which has been in place for a long time, where you have both players and owners, executives, and refs at the table talking about how the game is called, that there's going to be more consideration given to, like, do we need a full overhaul of something particular in the rule book, and that they've made a task force with multiple stakeholders, like, very businessy speak without a lot of, like, true actionable information in there, but they clearly have realized it is big enough of a problem, but you have to do something, or at least you have to look like you were doing something, right, and express that, like, something has changed. So, you know, much hasn't come out about that multi-stakeholder task force yet, but they did do something. They clearly, I think, that represents a change in how they're viewing this and how they're certainly talking about this to the public, that they have acknowledged, like, for the longest time, they just said, we have great referees and we trust them, and they recognize that they really can't say that with a straight face anymore.
So much of the public discussion focuses on WNBA leadership, and I would say mostly coaches and players, with some execs sprinkled in, as sort of the opposite sides of this divide. But, like, in between them are the officials themselves. And officials, I think, across sports are, by choice and by training and by etiquette almost, like, they're not out here, they're not giving press conferences, they're not, like, things like the two-minute report exist so that referees don't have to get up on the dais and say, like, okay, hey, we're taking questions around the room. But do you have any sense of, like, how the officials feel about their place in this, about whether they're getting what they need, about if this is a system that can work, if they're getting clear sort of communication from the league or from players about, like, how they want this game officiated? They are, in some ways, the most important part of this puzzle, but I feel like we know the least about their perspective on it.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, generally, my sense here, with these officials and with all officials, frankly, like, they want to do a good job. No one wants to screw up here. Like, it is a pretty grueling lifestyle to work your way up to be an officiator in the top of any league. Like, you have to really want this to do it, and certainly they're not a monolith. There are good apples and bad apples, but, like, they want to do a good job, and that's part of why I think some of these larger structural problems, it makes sense that, like, you know, these aren't things we would see in the CBA that's currently being negotiated between the league and the players, but the referees and the league also do a CBA, and I think there are things that can be addressed there that I am curious to see. Do we see meaningful change? You know, whether that's in terms of salary, training, resources, all of that. I think that is a real area where, like, they're here because they want to do well for the most part. Like, and that's a matter of kind of putting them in position to do that.
It's not a job where you get a lot of fame and glory and positive public attention.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned the CBA, which, you know, we're recording this in mid-November. The CBA deadline has already been extended once, but we're coming up on another deadline once again. There are so many moving pieces with the CBA between the players and the league at this point. Does officiating, like, fit into that conversation at all, or is it just sort of a, like, hey, by the way, we're pissed about this, but we recognize that within the context of bargaining, that's not really a thing that we're going to work out at the table, or is there room for it to be a part of the negotiation process in some way?
So not in a major way, but there is a small section of the CBA, if you're looking at the existing one they have, that touches on officiating. And there is something that's interesting to me here. One part of that is just about the competition committee, like ensuring that it exists and that players have the same number of votes proportionally as ownership, which makes sense. But the other portion of the CBA that touches on officiating is really interesting to me, and one that I haven't seen discussed much, which is just that once a year, if the Players Association wants to have a discussion about refereeing, about specific issues, about potentially specific referees, they can call that meeting once a year with league reps, referee reps, and player reps, and that can be held no more frequently than once a year, and only at the request of the Players Association. That's an area where I think, like, if you're talking about this as something that I would hope everyone wants to see get better, from the league to the players to the refs themselves, that would make sense to me to maybe expand the role of that it's not just something that is only called on demand, it can only be called once a year. Like, why don't you just open up more of a dialogue there? You can have that at the start of the season, at the All-Star break, and at the end of the season, or maybe just twice. Like, there are ways to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But that, to me, is the one lever you can kind of pull in the CBA. Should we rethink that as just the lines of communication, the way to have that open up? I think, you know, a lot of this is, like, yes, it's about specific calls or non-calls. It's about specific interpretation of rules. But it's also, I think, just about communication and respect. And I think that's why you've seen this frustration building, that players and coaches feel like they're talking about this and talking about it and talking about it, and no one was listening and nothing was happening. If you can open up some kind of space for dialogue where maybe it doesn't result in concrete changes or in concrete changes to the level that players would like them, but at least opening up that door to having them feel like they're not just screaming into the void and getting fined for it. I think that could go a long way. And so that is an interesting portion of the CBA to me, that, like, no, they can't flick a switch and suddenly referee pay is going to improve and they're going to have an offsite replay review center and they're going to get a last 2-minute report. But you can expand that portion of the CBA to maybe have those meetings be a little more frequently, to maybe, like, I don't know, require the presence of the commissioner and require the presence of the head of the referees union, like, all kinds of things you can do. And so I'm curious to know if they're going to try to work within that little portion of the CBA more.
That also feels like it would be of interest to the league itself, because the more opportunity to have formal, closed feedback, the less likely you are to have players sitting down at the interview table and being like, fuck these refs, I'm getting killed out here and they're not doing... Like, it feels like you would want a more open feedback system that wasn't so public and that wasn't going to lead to, like, outbursts that, while legitimate, are not what you want. Like, all leagues want these things to happen behind closed doors. Nobody wants all their dirty laundry out in public.
Right, exactly. And the language in the CBA there is that that meeting can be called no more frequently than once a year, which is, like, if you're finding people what feels like every week for these big explosions, really easy way to, like, open up other channels of communication, have these official meetings, whatever. But something, I think, has to change, and I would hope that the league recognizes that at this point.
You know, this is probably CBA adjacent as well, and this came up in the context of, Cheryl Reeve has talked about this before, and it certainly came up in the context of her getting fined $15,000, which I believe is the largest individual fine a WNBA, anybody in the WNBA has been hit with. There's no transparency to the fine structure either. So you will hear reports that so-and-so got fined, but the amount and sort of how you get from X to Y. That's also a big difference. Do you think there's going to be further push to sort of say like, hey, if you're going to have a fine structure, whether it's for comments about officiating or other sort of things that trigger financial penalties, it feels like players and organizations want that to have more sunshine to it as well.
Yeah, totally. And I think that just goes back to the idea of so much of this is about communication and respect. And I feel like transparency there is part of it. And I realize not every comment is going to like perfectly slot into a chart of like, they said the magic words, that's it. But I think having something like some kind of rubric, something so that players and coaches don't feel totally taken aback. It just, if you want to improve communication here, also feels like a good place to start.
So you mentioned that this has been like bubbling over time within the WNBA. And sure enough, if you like change your Google search results and say, what were people saying about officiating in, 2018, 2020, like it sort of like carries through consistently. But it's also an issue that has been simmering and in some ways has bubbled over in some very notable games in women's college basketball. Is that part of the sport dealing with the same category or the same issues with officiating? Is there anything different about the problems and complaints in the college game compared to what's going on in the WNBA?
Yeah, so I think there isn't the same kind of structural gap that you see when you're talking WNBA to NBA versus women's college basketball to men's college basketball, because the NCAA does standardize some of that. But you do have some of the same general frustrations of it being called games getting too physical and being called too loosely. And I think you can see the difference pretty clearly if you watch a men's game versus a women's game. Like it doesn't take watching very long to see like the freedom of movement seems to mean something different over here. So you have that. And I think part of that is honestly, like these are the exact same referees in many cases that work in the WNBA, because like that is how this system is set up, that they call games in the W in the summer and then college in the winter. So it's in many cases, literally the same people. I don't think the frustration is quite as extreme. I do think there is more of a standardizing factor with how the NCAA has its own version of the competition committee and how things are called. But I think there is something here to the fact that the games are just a little more physical. Players can get away with more, and you do see that pretty clearly.
Do you think, based on people you've talked to, like, where is sort of, if you could draw the sort of like the perfect line of we want the game to be this physical, is like, is there a consensus among players about like, we want to be allowed this much room, but not that much room? Or, you know, we want, I guess, you know, I'm curious if there is sort of a common understanding of how physical women's basketball should be in a way that makes the players feel safe and not get hurt, but also feel like they are not being hemmed in some ways.
Yeah, it's a hard question to answer because I think everyone is going to have a slightly different personal line here. But I think the general consensus that I've gotten is people want it to be called a little more tightly than it's called now, that it in some cases feels unsafe for players, like you said, but also a little more freedom than what you tend to see in men's basketball, that like they want to feel like there's a flow of game. They want to feel like they can operate a little more freely. That means being physical, just not quite as physical as it is now, which like there's not kind of a perfect line of like exactly this much contact is allowed, exactly this much space constitutes enough, but somewhere in between where it is now and what you see in the NBA kind of is, I think, where most people tend to land, which, you know, again, like that's not, there's not like a perfect formula here, but I think it is easy to imagine something in between right now and what it could be.
One of the ways in which I think that kind of manifests, and it's not exclusively this, because like Nafisa Collier didn't get hurt on anything that you would deem like a flagrant foul, but yeah. I think flagrants and when they are called and when they are not feels like a real flashpoint for this kind of discussion of like, hey, there's physicality that is crossing the line and the refs are inconsistently telling us where that line is. Like that feels like maybe not the whole of the issue, but one of the most crystallized ways in which it takes place, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, before the Nafisa Collier, Alyssa Thomas play, which, as you said, like that was not a particularly egregious play by any means. That was bad luck. It happens, I think. But the biggest conversation you had around when should a flagrant be called, when is it a flagrant one, a flagrant two, was, I think, an Indiana Fever Connecticut Sun game from earlier in the summer before Caitlin Clark got hurt that just blew up because devolved. I think there were several instances of contact that I think could have been called a flagrant. There was a flagrant one that should have immediately been clocked as a flagrant two. And that's just one of those things where if you have a clearer line there and you have refs who feel empowered to call that when they see it, as soon as they see it, there's still going to be physicality. There's still going to be tough plays that deserve flagrants. But if you're calling them immediately, it's less likely to have a situation where you have a game ending and national headlines on Fox News and like five ejections and crazy displays of like just everything getting out of hand.
So let's wrap by sort of talking about the potential solutions in your view, which you have written about, you've sort of sprinkled in here, but just to sort of like, if you can sort of say, these are the X things that the league should do to improve officiating, understanding, and we'll sort of like make this clear, there is no such thing as a perfect officiating system. You always have something that people want to have comments about. You will always have games that people aren't happy. Like, there is no perfect outcome to get here. But what can the league do systemically and structurally to make this work in a way that doesn't create this level of outcry and discord?
Yeah, like, it's never going to be perfect, like you said. But I think to make it better, I think probably when the competition committee meets this offseason, I think trying to draw a clearer line between what is allowed and what is not, and maybe taking some steps to make things be called a bit more tightly is probably a starting point. I think structurally, I think you need something like a last 2-minute report, something that just gives referees a chance to explain to coaches and players and the public what goes into a call or non-call in crunch time of a game. I think offsite replay review is a big one in my eyes. I understand the W has said that it's hard to implement when they play in stadiums of such varying size, that they're not all roughly the same size like NBA arenas. You have some teams in 4,000 seat places versus 19,000 seat places, which I would say is a bigger problem with maybe they should be considering that not that the league has grown enough. That,
right, right.
Yeah. But I do think they have to figure something out there. I don't think having referees review their own calls in real time in the arena on the sidelines is an answer. And then in terms of referee pay and training, you know, I'm not sure if making them salaried year-round employees is necessarily the answer at this point, given the footprint of the season. But I think whether it's increasing referee pay, trying to do something to shrink that gap between the experience of being an NBA referee or a WNBA referee, it's not going to immediately dissolve the idea that working in the NBA is a promotion and working in the WNBA is automatically lesser, but something to close that gap, I do think, is important. And so I think some combination of those factors hopefully would be enough to improve the situation, if not like wave a magic wand and fix it all at once.
Okay. Well, Emma, thank you so much for joining me again. You can follow Emma's work at Sports Illustrated. And like we said, in March 2026, you can look out for the book she's co-authoring, Court Queens, Celebrate the Players, Teams, and History of Women's Basketball. Emma, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Phantom Island is produced by Michael Serber and presented by Homefield. Our theme music by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard comes from the song Phantom Island from their album of the same name. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.